Thanks to Brian and Elaine for organising today's event. It's great to have an event like this on poetry in translation, but it's also fantastic to see such a good turnout for it as well. I'm going to speak for about 25 minutes, hopefully, and I'm going to talk. Well, the title of my speech is called "As If We Were God's Spies: Poetry Out of Nothing." Can you hear me up the back? Is that loud enough?
Yep.
Yep. Great. I find myself in a slightly difficult position. I've always felt that the most fascinating aspect of talking about translation, particularly poetry and translation, is hearing translators talk about the concrete details of the choices they've had to make as they're moving between two languages. And as these two languages come together, my experience is translating from Italian, mostly. Just think, for example, of the difficulties of trying to find an English translation for something like Buon Appetito, or for thinking about the cultural significance that are very and the sort of symbolic values that a very simple word like bread or pane has in Italian, which it doesn't have in English. Sliced bread in English is not the same as the sort of bread that you would get on a table in Italy. Hearing people talk about these sorts of things is often very fascinating, and also hearing people talk about their own ways of getting around them. I think there's a limit to how far theoretical discussions can take us in talking about translation. The meaning of two languages is as complex and as unique as the encounters between two human beings. The problem for me today is that I haven't been translating a lot of poetry recently, and I'm reluctant to go back and talk about the work that I was working on some years ago now, which finished in a book of an English edition of Italian medieval poet Guido Cavalcanti. So I don't have any juicy examples of the difficulties I've faced, or indeed the ingenious solutions that I've come up with. What I'm going to do is tempt fate and talk about poetry and translation in general terms. I'll ask your patience in what follows particularly the first part of what I say today regarding, I'm going to talk a bit about King Lear and Coleridge, seems more of a manifesto for poetry. What I hope becomes clearer as we proceed is how no discussion of the translation of poetry can avoid the question of what poetry itself is. Both the writing and the translation of poetry, I think, are very closely connected activities. Okay, that's it. I'd like to start by asking you to recall that very dramatic moment in the first scene of King Lear. Are you familiar with the opening of King Lear? You have done it.
Yeah? King Lear.
Queen Lear recently, that's right. You recall that the old king has summoned his three daughters, and he's about to divide up his kingdom between them. But before he does so, he asks them to declare how much they love him. Goneril and Regan, his eldest two daughters, speak very eloquently. Lear asks his favourite daughter, the youngest, Cordelia, what she has to say for herself. And she says, "Nothing, my lord." "Nothing?" King Lear replies. "Nothing. Nothing will come of nothing. Speak again." So my starting point today is that phrase, "Nothing will come of nothing. Speak again." And the questions, where do poems come from? And where, indeed, do translations come from? Do they come out of nothing? Or indeed out of something. Scholars trace the phrase, "nothing will come from nothing," to Lucretius and the concept expressed by the Latin dictum, ex nihilo nihil fit, or out of nothing, nothing is made. Lear speaks an admonition to Cordelia, but originally the phrase which Lucretius derived from the Greek tradition was used in a positive sense to argue for the permanence of life. Everything in existence must derive from other matter already in existence. Men might be afraid, Lucretius argues, because things happen whose cause they cannot understand. They attribute these to the actions of gods. However, such things are not created by divine agency out of nothing. Rather, there is an eternal stock of matter from which things continually arise and to which they must eventually return. And Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor, stoically says something similar. I am composed of the formal and the material, and neither of them will perish into non-existence, as neither of them came into existence out of non-existence. Every part of me will eventually be reduced by change into some part of the universe, and that again will change into another part of the universe, and so on forever. It sounds a bit like Walt Whitman there. Shakespeare, on the other hand, as I said, is using the phrase in quite a different way. He's using it more as a rebuke. If you can offer nothing, you will receive nothing in return. And in modern times, this is perhaps the sense most immediately understood. We might rewrite this in the light of the 20th century, whose burden we largely still carry with us. If you have no solid grounds for speaking, and of course you do not, given all that has happened in the last 100 years, then you cannot hope to speak the truth. Only the most forceful utterances will be heard in the marketplace. Nihilism is barren. For a long time I was under the sway of these words. Creation out of nothing, any creative act at all, seemed an impossibility because it rested on that nothingness. And yet, while Cordelia's inability to heave her heart into her mouth sets in motion the calamities of the play, part of that very tragedy derives from the fact that in truth we know her nothing to be much more pregnant with love and charity, her silence to resound with more life than the words of praise offered by her sisters. But what is truth, we have been taught to interject ironically or despairingly at this point, in echo perhaps of Pontius Pilate, and probably also of Goron and Regan. Well, in Shakespeare's play, as in life itself, we have only the good sense of Kent or the starkness of the fool to admire, but perhaps it is enough. What's more, whether we agree with Lucretius or not, on one level at least, all life and all art are born out of nothing. I did not exist, and now I do. The page was empty, and now it contains a poem, or perhaps a translation. It is this miracle of things coming to have a form and a substance that we must continue to celebrate. So that recently it seems to me that we need to focus our attention here on the creative act rather than trying to resolve the dilemma of God or no God or ground or no ground. Just as in translation, we must continually defy the impossibility of the act itself that Robert Frost, we've mentioned Robert Frost earlier, reminds us of. One of my favourite poems by Coleridge is Frost at Midnight. I don't know if you know it, it's sort of a meditation on a meditation that the narrator has in the middle of a winter night where he's sitting awake contemplating his newborn son who's sleeping in a cot. And it begins, the frost performs its secret ministry, unhelped by any wind. The owlet's cry came loud, and hark, again, loud as before. I've always been struck by those words, the secret ministry. The frost performs its secret ministry, he says. They evoke in us, I think, that same sense of awe we feel on seeing something like snowfall. There may be perfectly good scientific explanations for snow and for frost, and yet how often the sight of them returns us to a state of childish wonder, as if they came out of nowhere. Frost at Midnight is a poem which is full of such amazement. And actually for this reason it would be a good example of what Keats once called negative capability. Ironically so, because in explaining this concept, Keats distances himself from poets like Coleridge. He says, it's a very short, very famous definition of negative capability. When a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries and doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. Coleridge, for instance, would let go a fine, isolated, very similitude caught from the penetralium of mystery, the inner temple of mystery, from being incapable of remaining content with half knowledge. Yet Frost at Midnight, it seems, celebrates at least a number of distinct but related mysteries or examples of what we might call half knowledge. If the first is that Frost, which opens the poem, the second is the main theme of the poem, the birth of Coleridge's first child. And he writes, "Dear babe that sleepest cradled by my side, whose gentle breathings, heard in this deep calm, fill up the interspersed vacancies and momentary pauses of thought." Those interspersed vacancies, or the void, are now full of the breathings of a child who until recently did not exist. What better example of creation out of nothing? This is perhaps the most important task of poetry, to express delight and awe at the world as it is, and at the potential of this creation out of nothing, even where it means contenting oneself with half knowledge. But should that be poetry's charge? Is such delight merely childish? Is it possible or even right to treat it miracle and mystery in today's age? Late in the play, returning to King Lear now, late in King Lear, Lear fancifully and perhaps half madly imagines life in prison with Cordelia as a sort of paradise. And he writes, "No, come, let's away to prison. We two alone will sing like birds in the cage. When thou dost ask me blessing, I'll kneel down and ask of thee forgiveness, so we'll live and pray and sing and tell old tales and laugh at gilded butterflies and hear poor rogues talk of court news. And we'll talk with them too, who loses and who wins, who's in, who's out, and take upon us the mystery of things, as if we were God's spies." To take upon oneself the mystery of things. I love those last lines there. To me, they describe the poet's vocation in many ways. Importantly, I think this idea of taking on board the mystery of things adds a new dimension of responsibility to Keats' idea of half-knowledge. If the indefinite in Keats might be dismissed as a recipient for one's own imagination and romantic fantasies, Leopardi, indeed Leopardi, Giacomo Leopardi, the Italian romantic poet, whose hedge suggests the infinite in another famous poem. Leopardi suggests the infinite behind a hedge, but it's an infinity onto which the poet is free to project himself. Lear's phrase, on the other hand, suggests something much more, a responsibility, it seems to me, to care for and preserve the necessary place of mystery in the world, and of our need to come to terms with the inexplicable, beginning perhaps with the miracle of our own lives. "Thy life's a miracle," says the disguised Edgar to his father later in the play. His father, Gloucester, believes he has just jumped from the cliffs of Albion. And so the grounds for Edgar's words are quite false. Gloucester's fall and survival is a deception. And yet, when Edgar utters those words, "Thy life's a miracle," there's very little, even no sense of irony in what he says. The truth of the affirmation, it seems, remains. If anything, it hits home more strongly to the audience, because we see this double vision, the truth resting on a falsehood, but still as true, that's still true as true as ever it can be in a world gone awry. A world that no longer has its myths of progress to uphold. As Gloucester has said earlier, "We have seen the best of our time, machinations, hollowness, treachery, and all ruinous disorders follow us disquietly to our graves." Of course, it's quite difficult to remain open to this sense of miracle. Our lives are dulled not by the monotony of reality, so much as by a lack of meaning. That lack, with its ruinous disorders, is like a veil that mutes the world, only in moments of intense experience, such as those of falling in love or losing a loved one, does life feel really real. Pick up any anthology of contemporary poetry, and many of the poems will probably tackle one of these two subjects. What should we write about as poets? What should we be creating out of nothing? One could say that poetry tries to extend the range of experience we give lasting form to, so that it includes everyday existence while still maintaining its universal echo. Or perhaps we should use language that keeps the heart awake to reality, as Coleridge seems to suggest in another of his poems, the line, "Tree bough, my prison." He writes, "Henceforth I shall know that nature ne'er deserts the wise and pure. No plot so narrow be but nature there, no waste so vacant, but may well employ each faculty of sense and keep the heart awake to love and beauty." In hopeful moments, I think this could almost stand as a manifesto against the pessimism of our age. But then, I think the rhetorical high pitch of Coleridge as he reaches the climax of the poem is hard to enjoy today. A calmer, clearer voice is wanted. One that doesn't mince words or let too much weight be borne by those old trades, love and beauty. A voice like Cordelia's. At first, what her sisters have just said leaves her without words and keenly aware of the enormous struggle that she must undertake to speak with a skerrick of sincerity. As must we today, who find ourselves on the stage after a century that has had its fair share of the empty rhetoric of playful dissimulation and of self-aware deception. But how does this fit with translation? Well, it's sometimes said by poets themselves that translation is useful to fill in those moments when one feels there really is nothing to say. In translation, you are never faced with the blank page because there is already something concrete to work with. In this sense, translation puts a positive spin back on ex nihilo nihil fit, nothing will come of nothing. And in the lines, and in line with Lucretius, who you remember I said at the start, stated that for him, nothing will come of nothing was a positive proposition. It meant everything comes from pre-existing material. Even poems arise out of the pre-existing elements. The constituent atoms of a poem are the words of a language and its community of speakers. These existed before the poet, and in most cases, one hopes, will continue to do so long afterwards. The translation, in a sense, is useful for poets for another reason too, as a check against the dangers that accompany the view of poetry I've just been describing. Sometimes in the creative act, our hubris leads us to think that we, godlike, must conjure a world out of nothing. We forget the relation of the creative work to reality and to the community which gives it value. We forget the complex histories and values of its words. We seek a self-sufficient idiot, a bastion against the instability and the absurdity of the world. That, of course, is the paradox of language. It's a medium common to many people and therefore impersonal, but at the same time, one that we want to personalise in order to express our individualness. As Cordelia knows only too well, what words can she find to express herself after that assault on language by her sisters? Translation reminds us that the writer does not pull rabbits out of a hat. He responds to an existing situation. He takes on board mystery. But just as a translator owes an allegiance to the original poet, so too the poet owes an allegiance to render reality accurately. This is quite a common analogy in discussions of poetry and translation, and is often taken a step further. Just as reality is unstable and evades the author's attempt at representation, so too the original poem will always remain at one remove from the translator. And this leads us, of course, to the affirmation that the translation and the writing of poetry are both creative acts. Roman Jakobsen gave the most theoretical weight to this idea in the 20th century, but of course poets have long been declaring just that. Dante says in the Convivio, "No poem created with metrical or musical or poetic elements can have its..." Sorry, I'm trying to read my handwriting. "Can have its words translated without breaking all its sweetness and harmony. Nulla cosa per legame mosaico armonizzato si può della sua loquela in altra trasmutare senza rompere tutta la sua dolcezza e armonia." The contemporary French poet Yves Bonfoy has discussed these ideas at length, and like many, he's of the opinion that in translation, only creative transposition is possible. To argue this point, Bonfoy makes an interesting distinction between an individual poem and poetry in general. Poetry that becomes a sort of force, an activity. The poem, in a sense, is not an end in itself, but rather an opening onto what lay behind the writing of the poem and its language, and that is an experience of the world. For Bonfoy names this catalyst the act. The translator's task, on one hand, on one level at least, is to re-evoke that act, that initial intention or intuition, in another language and another cultural context. So he's making a distinction between a poem and poetry in general. And in such a distinction, we see the impossibility, but also the potential of translation. A poem may be a unique language object that cannot be translated, but a poem is itself a searching after something beyond language. Poetry can be translated. Poetry can take another form where the translator is open to that initial experience and open to the ways poetry relates to the language in order to reach closer to what Bonfoy calls presence. In framing the question of translation in this way, Bonfoy advocates the possibility of recreation, but also, I think, of a fidelity to an initial spirit. Of course, such a spirit remains vulnerable to a range of criticisms, some of which are not dissimilar to those that arise in discussions of Keats' Half-Knowledge or Leopardi's Infinite. And Bonfoy himself doesn't really resolve these problems in talking of the need for an affinity or a common destiny between the poet and the translator. However, it does seem to me that he is motivated by a rigorous sense of responsibility to that which he translates. There is a lifelong engagement with the poem, the poet and the language, perhaps even an obsession. I'm reminded of Ezra Pound and his decades-long obsession with Cavalcanti. Guido Cavalcanti was obviously a poet that meant a great deal to Ezra Pound. He produced some fantastic translations of Cavalcanti, but he did so over a long period of time. He tried all sorts of ways to bring Cavalcanti into English, to life in his own world. He started off by doing translations in a sort of pre-Raphaelite, what's known as a Wardour Street English. It sounds very archaic to our ears today. But 30 years later, he was translating the same poems by Cavalcanti in a sort of pseudo-Elizabethan English, which he felt was closer to the Italian medieval. But he also wrote poems in the voice of Cavalcanti. He wrote essays about Cavalcanti. He even wrote an opera, both the music and the libretto, about the life of his medieval hero. And it was almost as if Pound were living between two worlds, his own world and that of 13th century Italy. And in fact, it's not surprising that he believed in metempsychosis. Deep down, perhaps, many translators, to some extent, think, believe in metempsychosis. What I want to focus your attention on briefly, and in conclusion, is another aspect of this analogy that I've been trying to make between poetry and translation. And that is how, like Pound, Both writers and translators exist in a state of in-betweenness, or as the mid-20th century philosopher and religious mystic Simon Weil described, adopting a concept from Plato, in a state of metaxy. Writers exist between two languages and cultures, between the original and the rendition, between reality and the poem, between the creative act and nothingness, between their subjective selves and external reality. This existence as go-betweens can be frustrating and destabilizing. All translators will be familiar with that experience after having worked on the translation of a particular poem for some time, when it becomes impossible to read the original without your own version intruding. Suddenly, neither the original nor the translation seems to exist independently of each other. You are never wholly satisfied with either. Neither is an end in itself. You are caught between them. Weil writes, "The essence of creative kings is to be intermediaries. They are intermediaries leading from one to the other, and there is no end to this. They are intermediaries leading to God. We have to experience them as such." So that we might say translation, that process of carrying across, is both an activity and a state of mind, is an analogy for writing and for living in general. We are always in a state of in-betweenness. To adapt another aphorism of Weil's, the poem to be translated is a closed door. It's a barrier, but at the same time, it is the way through. Thank you.